DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Hello, Carol. This is E Pluribus Unum, where we dive deeper into the hive mind. This is your favorite podcast about the show Pluribus with Eric and Josh. Today, we're talking about episode 8, Charm Offensive. Before we jump into the episode, a couple items of housekeeping here. If you guys would like, please join us on our E Pluribus Unum Discord, where we're putting all our newest theories out there. I think after this episode, we'll have quite a few new theories and quite a few questions answered.
I have to recommend our other podcast, Dad, You're Wrong, where a Gen X dad and millennial son discuss everything from philosophy to film and everything in between. We have a wonderful time on that show, and we cover some really interesting subjects. So if you do appreciate our E Pluribus Unum Pluribus show, I think you'll probably appreciate Dad, You're Wrong. Even though I don't necessarily appreciate it, because apparently I'm wrong a lot.
So I'm told. Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to have a great episode coming up, our big end of the year top 10 lists as well. And we have a couple really cool special guests joining us on that one. So keep an eye out for that.
You know, I would also have to add something special for us. We started this show just a month ago, and we had nothing behind it necessarily, just the two of us coming up with the idea that we wanted to recap a show that we really enjoyed, and we hope to share thoughts and opinions and theories with other people. We just want to thank everybody from literally all across the world who have begun listening to us over the last month. We've grown from no listeners a month ago to over 1,700 listeners today, and it just seems to keep growing exponentially. And we are so pleased to have so many people taking their time to listen to us ramble on for an hour every week. Specifically, we want to reach out to a handful of really amazing countries that we would have never thought would have even tried to listen to us. So here's a shout out to Slovenia, Georgia as well. Thank you, Australia and the United Kingdom, for jumping in here. We have some lovely listeners in Spain, Ireland, France, Saudi Arabia, Portugal. Once again, we just want to thank everybody from the United States and everywhere else for just taking a moment out of your day to give our podcast a listen. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you so much. And for that one person out there seemingly in the middle of the ocean listening to E Pluribus Unum, thank you so much as well. Please hop in our Discord. We'd love to chat with you and see how you're enjoying the show.
Our theory is you are Lord Cthulhu, so please jump in. We would like to hear from you.
Well, I think that takes care of that. We can go ahead and jump into this episode. Do you have any initial thoughts on this one?
Marvelous episode overall. It looked like, to me, it was almost mirroring the previous episode in its structure. We had Carol begin the last episode, and we had Manusos in the center, and then Carol ended the episode. And on this one, it is the opposite. But as far as the story craft and the reveals and the performances, just another fantastic episode.
Yeah, I agree. I really like the title of the episode being Charm Offensive. And I initially thought that it was going to be Carol's Charm Offensive, and she was going to try a new route into the hive mind, which she does. But it's very much a charm offensive from the hive mind as well. And they sure do weaponize that pretty effectively, I think, throughout this episode.
I'll have to agree with you. I think it's a double-sided coin here. I think both parties are trying to be charming in order to get what they want out of the other. And we do start off with a blurry vision of what seems to be blood dripping on what could be a hospital floor. And I want to note in the slow motion dripping of the blood here that the first drop looked like the Petri dish that they've been using for the promotion and the Petri dish that we use for the cover of our podcast. And we get to see our buddy Manny, and he's lying on the bed there on his chest, and he is just waking up seemingly from whatever may have happened prior to that.
And we find out through one of the joint who's attempting to converse with him here that he did indeed have an infection from the aptly named porcupine trees that we coined last episode.
Mm-hmm.
But it is responding to antibiotics, so he is on the mend. And you could tell just by how Manousos wakes up that he is unhappy to be taken care of by the joined in this hospital. It looks almost as if he feels like he's been taken advantage of by them forcefully healing him. And I really love the shot of Manousos in the bed highlighting the scalpel.
And it made me wonder because of the look on his face, because the look on his face was pure anger. And you see the scalpel and you're like, man, are you going there? But luckily he doesn't. He, again, just illustrates his honor by, if you can, in a way of holding a knife to someone's neck, to say, no, I just want out of here. I also want to note the way the either surgeon or nurse is speaking to him. It's very much the, I would say, saccharine way that the joined can speak to people. And in typical Manousos fashion, he rolls up to the nurse's station and says, I need you to give me a bill.
When it comes to Manousos being that honorable, righteous man, he is still going to be paying his hospital bill.
And ambulance.
I adored that portion. It's just so part and parcel with the Manny that we've come to love here. As far as the color theory, I want to ponder this a little bit, but we see a lot of red and a lot of mention of red in this episode, not only with the blood, but also the red marker in which he writes this IOU for his hospital bill.
We also discovered that he is in Panama now. So they not only helped him out of the gap, but they helped him on his journey a little bit. And I don't know if this is part of their wanting to please him or if it is something else. And another note about red, all the signage around him is red. As he exits the hospital, all of the lighting is red in the emergency entrance and exit, and he jumps into a yellow ambulance.
It makes me wonder if this new introduction of red in this episode is almost signifying the upcoming conflict between our individuals and the joined. And I could also see it as our individuals, as they are approaching the conflict, maybe our yellow has shifted into a more aggressive red as well.
I think he's waited until now to introduce this color so that it has that tremendous impact. We have so many marvelous shots of cinematography and so many marvelous shots of the thing in the foreground is not as important as the thing in the background that's a little bit blurry. But after this, we get a chance to jump on over to Carol, who, as we note in the previous episode, had so heartfully embraced Zosia. And now apparently she has invited her in to have some lemonade.
Yeah, and even that lemonade is sort of a red-pink color. She's very formal, almost, and very nice to Zosia. Even asking, oh, is it too sweet? It's a very stilted conversation at the beginning. It seems as if not only Carol, but the joined are also having trouble reestablishing this relationship and having an awkward moment. And we have a fairly pertinent conversation specifically about the painting that Carol had stolen from the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum last episode in the Belladonna.
But did she steal it? I mean, you can't steal anything anymore. Nobody owns anything anymore, so you can do whatever you want, as Kumba has so clearly illustrated. I think it is pretty funny the awkwardness that they have there. She also ends up saying, which kind of breaks the ice, I don't really know what to say. I really don't know what to talk about. And I think that that's important because when you kind of confess that in an awkward situation, it does break the ice. And now you realize, you know what, we're both kind of awkward here. Now let's try to open things up. But she does compliment her on the painting, and Carol sort of plays it back. She's like, oh, you know, I was going to take that back. It's as though she realizes that there is and will be a world after this, and that means that this picture needs to go back to the museum, and it really isn't hers. She says, I just wanted to protect the image, you know, give it a safe place. I didn't want any roaming animals to infiltrate the museum.
Yeah.
And then she jokes later, well, you don't want a buffalo eating the Mona Lisa.
We even get a little laugh from Zosia as well. And throughout this episode, we really see Zosia act a little bit more individually with things like laughing and being comedic herself at the same time.
It's huge. I got to say, it's huge.
It's a stark difference from what we've seen in the past from The Joined. And I think that plays into the performative nature of The Joined. And sometimes they lay it on so thick, but it almost seems as if they're learning to pull it back just a little bit for Carol, but they still are making mistakes.
I don't think they've learned any lesson in the way that they should interact with the immune. And it's played out to the nth degree in this episode. So they are still socially stupid. I don't know what else to call it. Because it's not socially awkward. It's socially ignorant, even though, as she points out several times, you are the collective of so many human beings that have so much knowledge. How come you can't? And this also begins the break in the do they know everything? And I love how we get to see some cracks sort of break open in that. But as they break their sort of awkward nature, Zosia says, well, how about we play a game? And I think my favorite part of sifting through the games is Carol comes across Risk. And she goes, oh, world domination. That's hilarious.
There's a subtle portion of this where she says, oh, what about chess? And she says, oh, of course not. They have all the greatest grand masters of chess, so she doesn't want to play that. And Zosia says, well, you're also missing your white rook, but we can get another one for you. And this just shows that they're subtly going against Carol's wishes and utilizing Helen's consciousness, because who else would know that she is missing a white rook in her chess set but Helen?
It feels like a child that's testing their limits. Mm-hmm. You know, she seems to be kind of going here on her own. How deeply can we go? How much of this can we use? Also, again, it points out their lack of social awareness, that they honestly shouldn't be bringing up the fact that she's missing a rook. They shouldn't be bringing up the fact that there are certain games that Carol loved as a child. It's red flag after red flag. But, you know, Zosia at this point says, well, what about the game you used to play with your cousins back in the day? And this seems to be a perfect fit. It's a good, direct, simple game. It's a game that Carol hasn't played since she was a kid. And it gets them to the point to where they're sitting across from the table from each other and they're playing a game called Spit.
What a great name for a card game. I personally have never heard of a game called Spit, but it reminded me at least of a game I used to play as a kid. We called it War. This is the scene I was mentioning where we hear the color red again. When they originally played this game, her and her cousins as children, her Nana had a red deck and a blue deck.
And, you know, Nana says, be sure to put all the cards in the right boxes, meaning not to mix those blue cards and red cards into the wrong boxes. I want to point out something in this card playing scene, and that is the intimacy that builds between Zosia and Carol here. In fact, one of the first things we see is one of them slapping their hand on top of the others. And so this is not only a card game where you just sit across the table from each other, but they're touching each other. And neither of them seem to be put off by that. And it almost is an olive branch from the both of them that says, okay, I'm willing to be in the same room with you. I'm willing to play games with you. I'm willing to touch you. Zosia even asked her at one point, you haven't seen your cousin since 2005. Would you like to see them? And Carol aptly points out, that would be exactly like talking to you, right? And this is the first of Zosha's non-answer answers, and she simply just shrugs her shoulders and says yes. But I start to wonder, as we move on through this episode, if that's necessarily true. And it brings up a sort of a philosophical question. If individuals are part of the collective, do they lose their personal inclination to reach out to other individuals? Does her cousin now not, is he not concerned with wanting to go see Carol at any given point because now he's part of this collective? Or does he still have that individual draw to still want to do individual things? Do we still have a sense of that individuality in all of us? And can we pull from that?
And she ends it in such a great Carol way, right? As Zosha wins this round of spit, Carol gathers up the cards and says, it's like playing cards with fucking Google.
Yeah, because Zosha can't help herself from dropping the little information bombs. But, you know, Carol stepped in it herself. She was asking for the origin of the name Spit for this particular game. Zosha can't answer the question. Even in the collective, not everyone on the planet has a collective understanding of where the origin of the name Spit came for this game. Inasmuch as we think they do know everything, they actually don't.
Yeah, they're not omnipotent by any means. But I think that leads us into the next scene here, and it is with Zosha and Carol as they're overlooking Albuquerque, and you can see the city in the distance. And we find out that the Joined are indeed returning en masse to Albuquerque. And at this point, Carol poses a question, and I think this is something you and I had been wondering throughout the series, is where do you live? We soon find that out in the next scene as Zosha says, do you want me to show you?
And she even uses sort of this colloquialism. She says, wherever we hang our hat is where we stay. And that's such a human thing to say to me, but she's also smart to say, would you like to see?
As she takes her to the local stadium, we see a good amount of Joined creating a communal bed that they're all laying in. And we see all of them taking their clothes off and getting ready for bed.
But another thing that is freaking weird, none of this in any way, shape, or form looks comfortable at all. Why not have beds? Why not have bed covers? Why not have comfort for the human body so that it can sleep well and sleep in good health? It's almost like a prison camp or something we've recently dealt with in the United States here in Florida, but voluntarily. And it felt very creepy to me. But Carol finds comfort in it. You see her actually relax and her shoulders drop after she is introduced to probably your favorite character of the episode, minus Menousos, which would be Bear Jordan, this border collie. He rolls up and she asks specifically, this dog is not one of you, is it? And Zosha answers, no, definitely not. She didn't hesitate. She didn't non-answer. She leapt in there, no, definitely not. And not only that, she said it in a way of almost like down, like, oh, no, not animals. Mm-hmm. Or that's how I caught it. So I thought that was really important. And then she says, I didn't realize you kept pets. And then again, very emphatically, we don't. And then nices it up. We take care of the animals that are still attached to their former owners. And it does answer some heavy duty questions.
And there's one particular line in this scene that I want to bring up before we move on. Zosha mentions that the reason that they have this sort of communal cuddle puddle, we'll call it.
That's what Carol calls it.
Is because it saves on resources if they all sleep together. It's much easier to heat one large room as opposed to a bunch of small rooms. And there's actually a very subtle portion coming up here in the second act where I think they give us an answer on why the Joined are so adamant about saving resources, specifically saving energy.
Yeah, that's a big one. Well, at this point, we have Zosia asking, would you like to stay with us tonight? And I adore Carol's reaction because it's what she really wanted to hear from Kumba in Vegas. Uh-huh. Wouldn't you like to stay here with me? You can have your own place. But instead, we have Zosia, and seemingly the charm is cranked up to 101. Would you like to stay with us tonight? Knowing that is it exactly what Carol would want or would like. And Carol fights it for what she can. But the next shot is us very close to Carol asleep. And it looks like she could be at home. But as we pull back, she's in the middle of the cuddle puddle. And she has her arm draped over Zosia. And as she wakes up, she pulls her arm away from Zosia, sort of in shock, but we all know why. You know, she's desperately missed the touch of another human being, and maybe even specifically and especially Zosia. And she lays back and just sort of stares into space for a moment.
The next scene, we are returning to Carol's house, and even outside in the car, as she's dropping her off, Zosia says that she's had a nice time, and Carol actually admits to Zosia that she had a nice time as well. And it seemed to me almost as if Carol was begrudgingly admitting that she indeed had a nice time being with the Joined.
Yeah, I kind of saw it as that, but I also saw it as, you know, sometimes when you just react and it just comes out without you having thought about it first. I think she almost wanted to say it right after Zosia said, we had a very good time, we're glad to be back. And she didn't. She stopped herself, and then she couldn't the second time around. And she almost like a little kid, she goes, I had a nice time too. And she runs into the house. It was a sweet moment also, even though you do have these two offensives going toward each other. I, again, just like the hug and any other honest contact that Carol has with Zosia or the Joined, I believe it's real. It's true. And I feel her desperation of wanting to not only alleviate the loneliness, but also to have a companion. This gets us back over to one of my favorite rooms in the house, which is her office and her whiteboard.
And we see Carol add a number 6 to her list of things that she knows about the Joined. And she very emphatically writes, they eat people, almost as if maybe she did have a nice time with Zosia yesterday, but she wanted to remind herself and reiterate to herself that this is wrong. I can't succumb to this charm offensive that they're putting on me. To me, this really proves that Carol wasn't defeated in the last episode, as I had presumed. And you were very much right in our last conversation that this might just be the next step in her plan that she's enacting.
And note also that the color of her marker is purple.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I like following up with your color theory. It makes me very happy. I like it a lot. She definitely underlines people, and she puts a period after every word. This leads to a scene that you would think might be fairly innocuous, but it's not. Carol and Zosia go on a hike.
I really, really love this scene as Zosia and Carol are taking a hike up to a plateau, and we get a really great view of the desert surrounding Albuquerque. But in the background, we see an incredibly long train, and it brings up a great conversation. Again, emphasizing that the Joined are not omnipotent. And she says something about how she always loved the sound of a train horn.
She literally says, man, I love trains. There's just something about the sound of a train horn, you know? And I'm going to say this is Carol being calculative, and that she never loved trains. She never loved the sound of a train horn. Mm. And she's trolling. Because look at Zosia's response. Zosia looks at her like, this is new information. Here we have another moment where the Joined supposedly don't know something or everything. And I think this is Carol doing this on purpose. I don't think she had any affiliation to trains, because if she did at any point in her life, they would know. So it would be impossible for them not to know, even when she was a child, through Nana and her cousins or the kids next door or Helen or anybody else. I feel like she's trolling them. And they're very shocked. What? Hold on a second. We didn't know that. And she's like, oh, I thought you knew everything about me. And she says, not this. Very specifically, not this.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't make her line of, it is the loneliest sound in the world, not land any harder. That is her. She is that train whistle. She understands the depth of loneliness. And it does encapsulate Carol's experience.
And when we hear the train horn in the background, Carol asks Zosia, how do you do that? Zosia responds, something to do with the body's electromagnetic field, our natural electric charge, so to speak. You have one too, just unused. And Carol asks, so like radio? And Zosia responds, sort of, but radio transmission is like talking. It's conscious. Our communication is unconscious, homeostatic, like breathing. There's still a lot we don't understand. We're going to have to unpack this one, I think, a little bit here. But the first thing that came to mind for me was it might have possibly debunked my theory previously about Manusos sifting through the radio signals. And there was the one radio signal in use that was, you had mentioned, sort of in between signals or in between bandwidths. So is that not how they communicate, or is that still a possibility for us? It brings up a lot of questions and a lot of potential theories here.
Well, I like how she equals radio transmission to a physical form, and in the way they communicate with each other is unconscious. I still like your idea where you said this isn't magic. There's a scientific answer as to how they're able to communicate with each other. I also like, referring back to previous comments, she doesn't really answer the question here. And it actually provides us with more questions than answers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could very much see this information that she's getting specifically in this scene to be used as a weapon for our quote-unquote good guys in Carol and Manusos, absolutely. And I think bringing what Manusos has learned with studying the radio waves with Carol's knowledge as well can really get us to some sort of conclusion. And I don't doubt that we'll see something along those lines.
Well, and I'd like to support your concept of the 8.613 ham radio signal as being the signal that they are communicating on. We didn't go through ham channeling through all of these stations for nothing. There has to be something there. He's not going to do that to us.
And this conversation is sort of end-capped by the question from Carol, why do you guys still need trains? And after a moment of hesitation, Zosia responds, food distribution. And that genial conversation that they've had is now broken. They fall into tension at that moment.
It is the subject for which we will not speak. Right. Just like when a couple are having a fight and they don't want to talk about the thing that caused the fight, and you just kind of casually go on, is cannibalism. And I struggle with what happens later in the episode on Carol's behalf a little bit, not a lot, a little bit, because for some folks, this would be a non-negotiable.
Uh-huh.
I can't be with a person who is technically a cannibal, okay? For one. For two, how connected is this joined person in front of me to the collective when I'm with them, and how they feel and experience what they're feeling with me in this moment outwardly to the other joined? And actually, that's a wonderful segue into the next sequence.
Yeah, so we pick up with Carol and Zosia as they're at a spa getting massage. Carol asks Zosia, does this feel good to you? Is the whole world getting a massage right now? And Zosha responds, not exactly. It's kind of like in the last 10 minutes, there's been 1,674 deaths and 965 births. To feel everything at once would be unbearable, but we know it as it happens. It's such a haunting portion when she adds, we're aware that you just got goosebumps, and the goosebumps that she felt learning that information at the same time. Just absolutely wonderful.
Well, and she caps it off with, having said that, this massage feels good. So again, it's this thing where we get just enough information in an eloquent and succinct way, but also she non-answers the question. Zosha says, to feel everything all at once would be unbearable. That line alone is key, because it goes back to what Joe was saying in the last episode. Can we serve people? And moreover, my question to Joe at the moment was, can we turn off or opt out of people so that I don't have to be in the hot tub with Kumba, or I can be the surgeon or pilot? If feeling everything is overwhelming, there has to be a governor somewhere that they have control over. And I think this is important in a conversation the two characters have later, and I want to link this thought to that. The idea that you can either surf or opt out or turn off, other joined, so that you aren't in an unbearable state. It also seems like they have almost an alarm system, and we've seen it before, and we see it here where she says, you know, this many deaths, this many births. This man just fell on a fence. And she felt that in that moment. But it was almost like, alarm, this man fell. And, he'll be okay, no vitals. They need to flesh that out more, because it could make more sense as to who is in the hot tub with Kumba or who is flying the plane and how important that is and how much of you being more finite with your exercise in that person's skill or knowledge makes you further away from the joined or individual in some kind of an interesting way. They're really good to put it in your face about how much they know. Well, you can do that, but can you do the opposite of that? Can you get finite down to one singular character? And then is that something that Carol can use and in her way, for whatever reason that she's different, that is a way to flip that person out of the joined? We like to call them stupid theories. Here's a stupid theory for you. Wouldn't it be cool if it's not necessarily Carol's blood or DNA that they extract in order to create an antidote to bring people back around, but what if it is, and I'm going to point back to the Rolls Royce and the love balloons from the last episode, Carol and her true love for this humanoid in front of her that forces them out of the collective and back into their individual state.
I love that. That's great. That's an apt word to use for how I feel about that theory as well. This episode is such a hydra, right? As soon as they answer one question and you lop one head off, two more pop up right behind it. So I really enjoy that about this episode. And
it's simultaneously thrilling and exhausting.
Especially for us. Yeah, we got to talk about it, right? So.
Well, they do, I believe, after the massage, which they very clearly point out her scars on their back, by the way, from the grenade. And They don't play it down. They put it in our face. And frankly, they put it in Carol's face. Let's be honest about that. Why would they choose, of all things that they could do, a massage where you would clearly see Zosha's back? I mean, I got to say again, passive aggressive, really not good behavior. After the exchange between Carol and Zosha on the massage tables, this gets us to what I'd like to call the Kepler 22B scene.
And again, just scene after scene of it's all fantastic. I loved this episode so much. It's one of my favorite episodes. But this was shot in such an amazing way where we get a great overhead view as Carol is looking into
a very powerful telescope. And we find that Carol's looking at a sun by the name of Kepler-22. And in particular, there is a planet revolving around Kepler-22, which is Kepler-22b. And presumably, that is the planet the transmission is emitting from. We do know that it is roughly twice the size of planet Earth. It is in the Goldilocks zone, so there is potential for life. And it's most likely almost exclusively water. So incredibly interesting in thinking about the life forms that may be there and may be emitting this transmission.
Yeah, it makes me think of a couple of things. One, if you have a planet that is an ocean, how can that relate to frequencies, waves, and sound, and how that works? And you think about cymatics, right? You take sound and you apply it to a piece of metal with sand or something on it, and it creates these images. It creates these patterns and these designs. So water, frequency, waves, and cymatics, and the way that this transmission got to us and how it was utilized. It was utilized in a way to change our DNA by using this RNA. So all of that coming together, I thought, was really brilliant.
And Carol herself is also curious about what these life forms might be like. She says, "So what are people like on Kepler-22b? And Zosha responds, "We will probably never learn the first thing about them. They're too far away, but we know we love them. And we're grateful to them, and we'll pay it forward however long it may take. We have to share their gift with whoever else might be out there." And again, they're expressing their biological imperative here, I think, but it's also in the most sinister way. It gave me goosebumps hearing her talk about it like that.
It takes me back to saying how sort of religious and how evangelic this behavior is. It's obsessive, too. This is the only choice because of this biological imperative. I have to say, too, just as a tiny little sidebar, since we're talking about our water planet here, you know how they say the octopus is not from here and that they have a DNA that is otherworldly, that is not from Earth? Mm-hmm. Throw that in the stupid theory that the people that sent the message are octopus. Again, you're dealing with our water planet, Kepler-22b, and she does say that they're too far away. And when you sort of do the math, anywhere from 600 to 680 million light years away, it would take, even if they traveled at light speed, 1,200 years for them to get to us. But in our first episode, one of the scientists had said, we don't know how long the signal has been playing. So if it has been playing for longer than 1,200 years, they could be knocking on our door any moment now. And I would even posit that they're knocking on our door within the next 10 years, because that seems to be the lifespan of the remainder of the joint if they don't change their evil ways.
We return to Carol's house, presumably the next day, and I want to talk about some of the additions that Carol's made to the whiteboard. The first new addition we see is communal sleeping, communal puddle, and right next to it is sex, ? And that's one thing you and I have been talking about, is the hive mind breeding. We know that there were 965 births just yesterday, but that had to have from pre-joining. So we don't know if the joined are breeding in any sort of way.
Isn't that literally the definition of the biological imperative, is to continue to grow your species through mating?
Right. That's how it makes sense to me. So
all these other things don't equate to biological imperatives to me. Well, yeah. Certainly not in the way they define them.
Because even if they do get past this starvation episode over the next 10 years, they're only going to survive for another 60, 70 years without reproducing at some point.
The bounce that we get from the scene with them looking at the stars is Carol asking, how will you evangelically share this information with the rest of the universe, and we get the jump cut over to giant antenna in all caps.
That's the latest thing that she's added to the whiteboard. But we see communicate via bodies, electric charge, with a little star next to it, radio, telepathy, The next one is trains to transport food. The next one is individuals feel, everyone knows. The next line being signal from Kepler-22b. And the last one being building giant antenna, using up all power in world to send signal to space. And I think that clears up a little bit of the question of why exactly are the joined utilizing all of these measures to save power and to save energy? Because we know that if they were to send a signal into space, the amount of power that it would take to send that across space and have it reach another galaxy is probably more power than we're really able to utilize currently on Earth. So it's a big problem for the joined to solve. Again, so much to unpack in this scene alone.
Oh, it's huge. And just to talk about the building of the giant antenna and the power that it takes, we remember from episode one, one of the scientists says, how massive do you think that the satellite array would be in order to shoot a signal this far to us from 600 million light years away? And one of the guys says it would have to be the size of a continent. Think about that alone. Now we have an array that's the size of a continent, and it's going to take all of the energy of the entire planet in order to energize it. What if we're a throwaway planet and we're just tossing the ball off to whoever catches it next? And maybe even where we got the signal from, Kepler-22b, is just another bounce before it got to us. Because they're going to behave in the same way, I assume, evangelical, biological imperative, everyone in the universe needs this. How does that alone not lead to the devastation of the planet?
It brought to mind for me the Kardashev scale, which is a categorization of civilizations or interplanetary civilizations. Type one being a civilization that can harness the planet's energy, which technically humans aren't even a type one civilization yet. We're not to the point where we can harvest the planetary energy that is all around us. It seems in order to transmit the signal, they would at the very least need to be a, some sort of type one civilization, and we're just not there yet.
At this rate, I don't think we will be. After Carol's completed her list that is comprehensive and thought-provoking, her marker runs out of color. I think she likes this color purple, to be frank, and she specifically needs a new marker, contacts the joined and says, can you do me a favor? And Zosha comes by, drops off some new markers for her, and asks, is this what we think it is? Are you writing again? And Carol didn't even think about this. And she goes, yeah, that's what I'm doing. I'm writing. But every time she looks at her notes for her novel, you see her getting inspired. You see her wanting to return to writing as an artist, as a creative, as Carol. And she, every single time, kind of shakes her head and then just slides that writing board over to reveal the joined board that she has here.
When Zosha is asking if she's writing again, there was a certain excitement coming from Zosha. And I think there's a couple ways to look at that. Is it that Zosha and the joined are truly excited to have something new in the world that they can consume? Or is it that the hive mind want her to write the new Waikaro novel? Because if Carol is writing, then she's not trying to topple everything that the joined has achieved so far. So a couple of different ways to look at that, I think.
Yeah, and she accuses them of this later on, but I would also say in the way that Zosha answers it, she seems genuinely thrilled that something new comes across the table. Here's something that I think is awful about the joined, and this is the way that I might disagree with Joe's theory from before, it's not transcendent. It's homogenized. Uh-huh. And from this point on, no one can have an original thought anymore.
I absolutely adore that. That's what I want Zosha's feeling in this scene to be, that they are missing something and there's something lost when you become one of the joined. I think that is absolutely fantastic.
Well, and it's the same reaction that Kumba had with his avocado toast and Carol. Here's another unique human being sitting across from me, showing me something I hadn't seen before, something new, something unique, something original to me. That's what makes it interesting to me. I would say that also is what makes us human, our individuality, not our vegetarian, cannibalistic collective.
I think it goes back to the conversation of the joined being this metaphor for AI. AI doesn't create anything new. It's just repurposing things that have already been created, and it can never create something on its own.
Yeah, he's going to have a hard time fighting. This is not about AI to some degree, especially when he closes his show out with this was made by humans.
Yeah.
Even if he was ahead of his time and having written it 4 years ago, I'm still okay with that because he's essentially also not wrong. After this, she goes back in, and this is again where she faces her whiteboard and she's reviewing the notes of her novel. And she's seriously considering now, hey, I have an audience here as a writer would, and go, I do have an opportunity to do something that I really enjoy doing here. But she still grabs that whiteboard and slides it across. And she finishes the addition to her antenna revelation. How? That is the last question she writes on the board. How are they trying to do this?
And that's the question of the day, right? How are they going to produce the amount of energy needed to transmit this broadcast? So a lot, again, another Hydra, right? Another question that's popped up here. Well, into the next scene, we find Zosha and Carol, and they're at a empty football field, and they're playing the very fun game of croquet. As Carol misses her first croquet shot, Zosha hits hers and it goes right into the goal. And Carol brings up a really fascinating question. Do the joined share muscle memory? Even though Zosha mentions that she has all of the greatest croquet champions within the hive mind, do they share that muscle memory? And again, we get one of those non-answers from Zosha. And she just answers, maybe. Or maybe you just suck, Carol. And we get a great joke in the background on the Jumbotron. We see, you suck, Carol, come up, and a bunch of stars flashing over it. I thought that was a fairly funny scene, but we get the sinister undertones of her not specifically answering that question as well.
She does what magicians do. She distracts you instead of answering the question. And I think the question actually answers itself. We already know. And we already know it from episode one. You have the TGI Fridays pilot. And you have people that are seemingly out of character, according to their costume, doing remarkable things. Who's to say that this signal isn't changeable now that they're connected? And you can't reprogram them to do other things that would go against their biological imperative or whatever they want to call their philosophy. So, yeah, when she does the good non-answer, that is probably one of the biggest distractions. Oh, hey, look at this shiny thing over here. We don't want to let you know more about how capable we really are.
Because that is the scary part, right? It's
one of
them. Portion. Yeah.
Yeah, I got cannibals that are capable of being an entire world of an army that can go against me and my 12 cohorts. Yay.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that gets us over to Laughlin's Diner. When we roll up to the place, we assume it's been there for a long time and Carol just hasn't been there for a while. But we find out, actually, it's quite a bit different than that.
Yeah, as we hear Carol, and she's sort of reminiscing. She's going over her early days of riding. And even in the previous scene, Zosha asks her, what was your best day of riding? And Carol's response is such a Carol response. she says, "What was the most fun you had getting your teeth drilled?" or something like that. So it was pretty great. But this sort of builds on that. And Carol is going over her early days as a writer when she's writing on legal pads that she's stolen from her work. And there is a waitress named Bree who was always there, and she let her sit there as long as she wanted and always kept her coffee topped off. But as she's reminiscing and all these memories are coming back, we find out that, wait a second, this diner burned down.
Right. When you see that hit her all at once, it is the culmination of all the things that she's experienced with Zosia since she and Zosia saw each other the first time with the hug, and all of the manipulative things Zosia has done to her up to this point. I think it just all landed on her, especially when you take a restaurant that had literally burned down and completely recreate it from scratch. Also, frankly, terrifying. Also, again, let's go back to our thought of how much forethought the Joined have. They had to have taken an immense amount of time to come up with all the materials and build it. And it looked like it had been there for 40 years. You had duct tape on the seat, all the little details. You can't tell me that doesn't take a significant amount of time. And maybe it was the last 40 days that Carol had been alone. I don't know, man. That's a lot to get accomplished in such a short period of time without having some sort of foreknowledge of that or something. And it has to be more than just the collective people inside of the Joined having their version of their history with Carol and their knowledge of Carol. It has to be more than that. Here's where I would drop this phrase about the Joined's behavior: love bombing. That's exactly what they are doing, so much so that they're going to recreate the place of her origin. Again, overreaching, love bombing, too much, poorly thought out. And now I realize I just found myself in a love bomb trap, and this diner shouldn't be here. I thought they were going to say that they almost reconstituted Bree from something. I was glad to hear that they just brought her in from Florida, but way too much. And of course, Carol's reaction of her literally freezing up, almost like the Joined do when they get their transmission, and Zosia even asks, "Is everything okay?" And in perfect Carol performance, she stands right up, walks out the door. The traffic outside literally stops. She gets in the little blue car and hightails it home.
And she had even ended the conversation with, "Those were the best days." And she kind of lets it land there. And as the manipulation is kind of laid bare, at this point, we see that the facade has fallen away from Carol. And she is now angry again because they've tried to recreate the best days of her life. And we pick it up that evening in the next scene where we see Carol standing on her balcony overlooking the cul-de-sac, and she's having herself a drink, and she sees Zosia drive up, and Zosia comes in, and Carol is pouring herself a drink, and she offers Zosia a drink somewhat angrily. Zosia says, "We'll take one if that's what you want." And Carol asks, "Would it kill you to say I?" And even at that point where Zosia tries to change her vernacular here, the Joined still struggle to say I. Carol even says another great Carol line here: "All the brains in the world and you can't navigate a fucking pronoun."
That works on so many levels, without a doubt. It calls back to John Cena. We are John Cena. I believe that was the first time we saw them break from the "this individual is" or "I." And I wonder if the longer you're steeped in the Joined, the more joined and more homogenous you become. And Zosia's response is actually smart. She says, "Well, it's difficult for me to work in singular pronouns because they're not." And so she has to go in character almost to do that.
At this point, Carol begins asking Zosia about Bree, the waitress from the diner. and asking about where she was prior to them shipping her in to reassume this waitress position, just to give Carol this distraction. And she even mentions that. She admits that the hive mind is trying to distract her and trying to knock her off this course. And she says, because I haven't given up, tell me you know I won't give up. And Zosia responds, we know, we wish you would.
She delivers one of my favorite lines in this episode for sure, but also it just so clearly defines my feelings on this show entirely and the Joined themselves. She says, it's all an act. It's manipulative bullshit because you know I haven't given up. Right there, it's manipulative bullshit. That's what I've said since episode one. That's exactly what all of this stuff is.
Word for word, that's what you've said. Yeah.
Yeah. And notice that Zosia doesn't respond to that. And I think it, again, goes back to my heart of heart theories, is that they are duplicitous. They are manipulative. They are deceptive. They pretend not to be. And I think they almost pretend not to be all things, but we can see if that plays out later. But this is where the cards literally end up on the table.
Carol says, I like you, you people. There's a lot of things that I like about you. She's really admitting that there is some sort of adoration or some sort of longing for another person, and that she sees that there are maybe even some good aspects to the Joined, but she knows in her core this is wrong. And she says, someone has to put the world right, even if it means you all leave me again. Even if that means I'm, and she again lets it lie there, even if it means I'm all alone, she has to put the world right again. We get really from Zosia the biggest weapon of all, I think, at this point.
Yeah, this scene deserves a good solid breakdown. What I think I got from this was it wasn't that she likes the Joined. I think she likes Zosia, and for all the reasons that the Joined chose Zosia to be the ambassador to Carol, as we saw from the very first, second episode. And look, it's working. What is the line that we love so much from this show? Why does she have to be so goddamn fuckable? And we know that Carol has fought that this entire time. How can you not? Now we're in this position where she's putting her cards on the table, not only for confessing she's not giving up and that she knows that they know, but this is a train wreck. It is unsustainable. This is a mental illness. It is a psychosis. You are starving and you cannot pick a goddamn apple off a tree. Someone has to put the world right, even though you may all leave me. And so she tells this person that she cares about, seemingly, and maybe there's a little bit of Helen in there, and maybe there's a little bit of Zosia, and maybe there's a little bit of the pirate queen in there, but she's being brutally honest here. And I agree with her 100%. And again, just like an evangel or like someone with a mental illness, Zosia ignores the entire thing and goes with the final weapon that she has left, which is physical love. And when I first saw this kiss happen with Zosia leaning in and trying to kiss Carol, and Carol kisses her but then pulls back, I thought, man, do they have another kissing scheme that they're trying to work here to see if she kisses her and she turns like we began the entire series with? It certainly called to that, I think. Secondly, of course, we have what I considered to be the most practical response in Carol is she is practically starved of physical compassion and attention. And she leaps in feet first, or I would say face first. When I'm watching it, I don't assume everybody's watching it all at the same time. But back in the day when you watched television, we all did watch it at the same time. And in the back of my mind, I heard a collective scream from millions of people watching this episode, because I know millions of people were dying for this particular scene to happen.
I let out my own little scream over here in Chicago, certainly. She brought out the big guns, right? She brought out the atom bomb on the weaponizing of Carol's loneliness. And well, you can't really blame Carol for where she is and the things that she's experienced. And after a fairly fervent makeout scene, it has a really great cut to Zosia alone in Carol's bed. Again, she's laying face down, so we get a really great look at the scars on her back from her saving Carol. And as Zosia rises from the bed, she finds that Carol is on her computer, and we find out that Carol has been working on a brand new chapter one for her Waikaro novel. This scene and the previous one felt like the culmination of the charm offensive, and we do have a clear winner here. And that, unfortunately, is the Joined. Seemingly, they have used their final weapon against Carol and has defeated her and has won this round of spit, if you will. Carol presents Chapter 1 to Zosia, who goes upstairs and reads it alone and comes back. And again, we have a scene here where Zosia is going over the chapter, and we find out that Raban is now a woman as well in this latest novel. And they're going over a lot of the lore from the Waikaro novels. And I feel like there's something more there that I haven't dug into enough. And there's possibly something within the lore that they're hinting at. But there is that performative nature of how much Zosia loves the first chapter of this novel. I think she loves that Carol has begun the creation process again and is distracted. And there is something new coming into the world.
I want to point something out that may seem innocuous upon first viewing, but I think is vitally important. When Zosia wakes up in Carol's bed and sees Carol writing again, she smiles. Now, think about this. She's not playing to anyone. She wakes up and smiles as she sees Carol writing. Now, I think this could be a couple of things. I think it could be, as you mentioned, they are actually genuinely pleased to be able to find something brand new in this world that they know so well. And I think that's all of us. Sometimes the newest thing is the most exciting thing. Secondly, I think it's another indication of the breaking from the Joined through individuality, meaning it's the actual Zosia smiling as she sits up in bed. Beyond that, the rest of that scene is so wrought with, we'll call it insider speak, I guess. If you were a super fan of these books, you know all of these little phrases. And they're placed in such a great way that if you remotely know about fantasy novels, you can basically follow along with what they're saying here, and it's fun and fantastic. But I'm going to disagree with you on her capitulating to the Joined. I think she purposely wrote this chapter for the Joined and made Raban a woman for the Joined, because that's what they expected. And she's still using it as a tool in her charm offensive. Her charm offensive is not over just because she got some. She's more empowered now than ever.
I think that you very much may be onto something here, because much like the hive mind, I may have once again underestimated Carol, and that this is all a part of her La Turca plan, if you will.
I like that. Look, we're not all Bear Jordan here, is what I'm saying. And it is a great conversation. And the way that the conversation ends, Carol asks, so you like it so far? She is a master of her craft, but she still wants to know. And Zosia says, I love it. And she consciously made the effort to jump into the I love it. Mm-hmm. without prompting. And I think that that's another pin in the idea of the breaking away individually by sharing love with Carol specifically or any of the unjoined.
And we get that very much in the next scene here. As things are coming to a close, we get our time stamp here of 60 days and 8 hours and some odd minutes. But one thing I wanted to point out early in this scene as we are getting our time stamp is there's a radio playing. This is a actual radio station. Did they bring back a radio station specifically for Carol to listen to? Because the hive mind's not out there listening to radio. And the song that they're playing even is Miles Davis, All of You, which I thought was really great. But we pick up with Carol as she's washing some peppers at the sink, and she looks out and is staring at Helen's tombstone. And I think that might actually jive with your theory of this is all part of her plan. This domestic life that she's living with Zosia, it might be all for show because she's staring at her real love and not this fake love, this manipulative love.
The reflection of her looking through that back window onto Helen's grave, I think, is quite telling. And I'm really glad that you brought that up. And Zosia's like, oh, I hope you're making enough for two. Man, I immediately felt like, oh, I was kind of looking forward to you bailing because I need to get back over to my whiteboard and all my theories about your weird ass. But instead, we're going to have to sit here and talk about omelets. This is the conversation that I find probably most important in my theory, but I'd like for you to kind of run over the omelet conversation a little bit.
Seemingly at this point, Zosia has completely shifted to utilizing I and me and my. And Carol asks her, do you like omelets? And Zosia responds that I do like omelets, even though I didn't have many opportunities to have omelets. And Carol asks her, well, what is your favorite food? And Zosia responds with this story about not the joined and not the hive mind, but the individual that is Zosia and her specific story with loving mango ice cream. At this point, Zosia is almost exclusively speaking with individual pronouns as opposed to collective pronouns.
I think this is an expected result of Carol's charm offensive, that she has essentially forced Zosia into using I instead of we, so much so that it was more comfortable and easier for Zosia to fall back into her original self and begin speaking in first person. And I can't help but have this lean into my theory that the more interaction they have with Carol, and frankly, in this instance, the more intimate interaction that they have with Carol, that she is the antidote, whether it's, you know, the theory before about using her DNA or her blood as an antidote, maybe her love is the antidote. And the more that any one of them hang out with her for extended periods of time and or to the level now that Zosia has with her, they have a switch that can possibly switch them back to their individuality. And this scene right here is the apex of that theory, that we saw her delight in her story of the mango ice cream, so much so that Carol saw her delight in it and touched her hand and said, thank you for sharing that. And I believe she honestly felt that because this is the first time that Zosia had been that individual that Carol so desperately wanted her to be. Up to this, she was Google. And this person in front of her right now is not Google.
I really love, within the last couple episodes, really exploring the conflict within Carol and her relationship with the hive mind. She truly meant that she was thankful that Zosia shared this memory with her. And it wasn't a memory of the hive mind. It was a memory of the individual. So I really love that. And we get a great performance out of Zosia, not only in telling her the memory that she has of this mango ice cream, but right after that, when she completely freezes up.
And it's very similar to how the joined froze around Kumba when Carol was approaching Las Vegas. And there's just a split second of Zosia seemingly completely terrified, and that deep fear within her that whatever's happening could have just ruined all of the work that I've put in over the last couple weeks here with Carol. And it could all be for nothing as she responds, "You're going to have a visitor."
There's no doubt it was terror that crosses her face. It suggests she knows that these two are coming together and that that is a major problem for the joined, especially with how strong-willed they are trying to get back to the old world.
It just goes to show how formidable Carol and Manusos are, that a hive mind of 7 billion plus people could have a fear of these two joining together. I think that is quite wonderful. But we pick up with Manny as he is treating the wounds on his back, and we're back at his yellow ambulance with a yellow gurney inside. What I loved was as he's pouring the peroxide across his back, we even see it bubble up. It was just such a great little piece of special effects. But he hops back in his ambulance, and we see that he is just 31 kilometers from the Mexican-American border.
Well, that essentially gets us to the tail end of the scene as Manny wheels off toward Carol, and we anticipate the two of them meeting in the next episode. I gosh darn hope so.
At that border, he's 8 hours or so away from Carol. So in the grand scheme of things, that's a fairly short amount of time. So I think they'll be meeting up the next day, and I'm very much looking forward to that.
Excellent. Well, do you have final thoughts on this particular episode, and how are you feeling about the final episode?
I thought this episode was magnificent. It's one of my favorite episodes. We got so much information and so much more questions brought up. I can't wait for the next 7 days to come by because I'm so excited to see how they wrap this up. And I got a feeling that they're not going to end us on a calm note. I think there's going to be quite the cliffhanger at the end of this season that's really going to keep us for the amount of time that it takes for season two here. So I am incredibly excited. I haven't even seen the title of the next episode. Do you know what that is?
I do, actually. The final episode for season one, episode 9, is La Chinga o el Mundo, The Girl or the World.
I love that. That's great.
Yeah. It harkens us back to Manuso's tapes as he's learning English a little bit there. For those of you that don't like calling the trees the porcupine trees, they are Chunga palm trees. They are the spiny trees that Manusos fell onto in the Darien Gap. So feel free to call them that. I personally like porcupine trees myself. This particular episode was directed by Melissa Bernstein, and it was written by Johnny Gomez. I think they knocked it right out of the park. I'm super thrilled about what is to come next for the upcoming episode, and I'm sure our listeners are too.
Well, I think that'll do us for today, Carol. Thank you so much for listening to E Pluribus Unum, your favorite podcast on the show Pluribus. If you like what we're doing here, please hop in and join us on our Discord. We would love to chat with some of you guys and share some of our theories and hear what you guys think of the show. I'm sure there's plenty of stuff out there that we miss that you guys have picked up on, and we want to hear from some of our overseas listeners as well. So please hop on there and chat with us. If you like what we're doing here, hop on and join us on our other podcast, Dad, You're Wrong, where Gen X dad and a millennial son duke it out over everything from movies to philosophy and everything in between.
Once again, we want to thank everybody for listening. We've been having such a great time as we record these podcasts and get them out to you. So thanks so much for sharing this little world with us. And we look forward to seeing you guys next week.
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.